Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
The point is that there's also new ideas and kind of ways of thinking about problems that really, if we don't allow that, if we don't give people some space to think outside the box, like we're going to be stuck in the box.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's a very small, yeah. I believe it's a very small box.
Yeah.
That's the voice of Liam Bannon, my guest in this episode. And Liam was never one to be stuck in the boxes. Liam is a professor emeritus, and he was the founder and director of the Interaction Design Centre at the University of Limerick in Ireland. As you'll hear in Liam's telling of his own story, he was always looking for the links and ideas outside of and in between the boxes. He's been a hugely influential thinker, writer, and researcher, along with his various collaborators, in shaping work around technology and design, contributing especially to the areas of human-computer interaction, HCI, and computer-supported cooperative work, CSCW, and doing so drawing on his very broad disciplinary interests. One thing I think is particularly interesting, given all that is happening now with AI, artificial intelligence, are his reflections on being around the first wave of AI in the 1970s. I think it's also really interesting the way his career story provides a personalized account, in a way, of the story of the development of the fields of HCI and CSCW. More generally, I think his story is an example of the opportunities and challenges that come from trying to shape your own path and follow what you really believe in and what interests you, albeit recognizing that he was able to do this in a different era of academia. Starting at around 37 minutes, he also steps back from some of the details of his career and reflects more generally across some of these issues. I should say here that we recorded this interview in 2017. Yes, you heard that right. And this was at the ECSCW conference in Sheffield. So a small heads up, because we were in person, there's some cross-microphone capture and back-channeling, so it may not be as clean as if we recorded it remotely, but still more than understandable. And I'll also just add that at this time and in the ensuing period, Liam has been dealing with some really significant and serious health issues. We're going to record a part two of our conversation to continue some reflections on these experiences, as well as his more general reflections and lessons learnt that we can take away from his career. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Liam Bannon.
I'm really delighted to be able to speak with you today, Liam. So thanks for giving me the time. For people who don't know you, just a little bit of context about your background. What your first degree was?
Cognitive science, psychology? Well, it was science. Actually, it was a science. I had an interest in high school in both kind of the arts and the sciences, and so it was a bit of a problem as to what direction to go in. I remember this teacher saying, do science, you might get a job at the end of it. So I did science. So it was maths, physics, chemistry, biology.
Yeah.
My interest was chemistry, really, but in terms of those subjects. But in the second year of my undergraduate and that degree, they had a new program of maths, psychology, computer science. This is back in 1971.
That's a bit of a radical combination.
Yeah, it was a bit strange because psychology was actually in the arts building, in the arts faculty. And computer science had just been introduced as an undergraduate subject the year before, 1970. So it was very new as an undergraduate student. So I didn't really know much about psychology or computing. I remember going out that summer before the start, it just appealed to me as something a bit different or curious. Mm. So there were about 12 of us who took that option. And of that 12, then we would traipse over to psychology lectures in the arts building every every day. And I really enjoyed it because what psychology, the undergraduate program in UCD in Dublin, was a very general one. It meant you introduced you to everything, all different areas, animal behavior, perception, learning, memory, educational psychology, personality, statistics, physiology, you know.
Wow.
And so it allowed, I just found it was great because I knew in a sense I was really a wordsmith. My interests were more English history and that. So this opened out that, it put me back, even though I was in a science program. Then the third year we did computer science and psychology. At that stage they didn't have an honours degree in computing. So we just had a general degree in computing, and then the final year we just did psychology. So I ended up, and that, in that last year especially, I became interested in relationships between the two, computing and psychology. And there were two areas, obviously, of interest. One was the modeling, thinking of the computer as a model for the mind. And so a lot of psychologists were thinking of inputs and the information processing model. And of course, I was interested in that. Another area was, of course, then the idea of artificial intelligence. And I became interested in thinking of the computer as a model for the mind, as something to help us understand the mind. And I was interested, basically, in cognition and thinking, the mind, language. They were my main interests. I also found computing interesting, and you know, some of the semantics of programming languages and things like that. Some aspects of computing I found interested. The second area of interest, which was a more practical one, was that I worked as both an instructor in computing, but also on the help desk in the computing center. And I started to pay attention to the concerns of people with using the technology. And this is in the days of punch cards and that. But there was still this issue of, like, people, errors that people were making in compiling and running programs. And so I had that sort of human factors interest in computing systems. So what that led to was a feeling I wanted to move on, but I wanted to be more in psychology, on the human science side than on the computer side. I wanted to do both.
Yeah.
So there was an opportunity to do a master's in computing in Trinity in Dublin, a one-year kind of taught master's. They just started in computer science. And we had some funding for it. So I did that for a year, and I did a small project on looking at programming errors. So I collected data on people running programs and what were the most frequent errors and things. It was fairly basic, logging study, basically. And then I was thinking about doing further work, and so I was looking for positions or doctoral positions in outside of Ireland, so mainly in North America. And I was thinking about, I wanted to be sort of in AI, but not in, like,
not
the,
in the
straight computer science AI.
The technical aspect.
So I was looking for people who had psychology and computing, and at that time there were about three or four groups. There were some of the Carnegie Mellon people crossed, like Newell and Simon and that. There was Norman and Lindsay and Rummelhart, kind of the people at San Diego. There was a couple of people in Washington State, Hunt and some people. And then I was reading at this stage kind of AI articles, and I was a member of SIGART, and like used to get the newsletter, and I was quite young and trying to learn. We didn't have courses on AI now. In actual fact, our psychology teacher was totally against the idea of AI. But I felt it was, I was kind of a proponent of thinking of it as a new way of thinking about the mind. So I, by chance, came across an article by somebody who wrote a review of Ichikai 73, I think it was. This was in 74 or so. And it was by this guy with a very strange name called Zenon Pilishin. And I was curious, who is this guy? And he was at a place called the University of Western Ontario. And I said, where's that? And it's in London, Ontario, in Canada, near Toronto. And I looked up his background, and he was an interesting mix. He was an engineer initially, who then did psychology. So he had a computing background and a psychology background. He also had interests in philosophy of science.
Yeah.
But he was in the psychology department two-thirds and one-third in computer science.
So you recognized a kindred
spirit.
So
I thought, this might be somebody interesting. And then I contacted him, and he sent me a couple of papers, and I read them, and I What the Mind's Eye Tells the Mind's Brain, one of his very classic papers. And I thought, this is interesting, so I went there.
Right. So I'm going to put a link on the webpage to an article that someone wrote after interviewing you that actually talks through
a little of
all of your career moves. One of the things that really strikes me when I think about you is, and it's reflected in what you said at the very beginning about your interests, is how eclectic you are. And what I think you've done in terms of contributing to the field is doing a lot of that bridging between different fields and often being at the forefront of some of the new bridges that emerge, whether that's some of the early cognitive science stuff or the participatory design stuff. How did you get to the sort of lead of these waves?
Well, because in a sense, I mean, around that time, cognitive psychology was reaching out in terms of trying to understand the mind. And so it was the start of the whole, the cognitive movement was in the 60s with Bruner and Miller-Galanter Pre-Brain Plans and Structured Behavior. So that had been on nicer cognitive psychology. So this was the first movement in terms of trying to understand more, thinking of the mechanisms of the mind. And so in that sense, one example of mechanism we had was the computer. So it became interesting to think about how could we, if we build, it wasn't the idea of building a robot so much, that wasn't of interest to me. It was the idea of having a mechanism by which we might be able to explore the functional way in which something could happen in terms of the mind. So that was what was of interest initially. And so in that sense, cognitive science was emerging around this time. And actually my supervisor, Senan, was one of the major players in that whole emergence of cognitive science in the 80s, or in the 70s, late 70s, mid 70s. So I was kind of aware of his circle of people and contacts. He was visiting at MIT at the AI lab. He was visiting with people at Carnegie Mellon. We were on the ARPANET. We had a dial-in to the ARPANET even in those early days. So I was kind of aware of, you know, it was the first time for me, like, being in a research environment where here was somebody who was intellectually in the vanguard, kind of connected in this movement. So interdisciplinarity, mixing kind of computing, psychology, and also to some extent like philosophy and neuroscience, is kind of thinking about mind. So that was one phase, the kind of the, and linguistics also, actually, language and language mechanisms is also in there. So that was cognitive science. And then a few years later, we had, I could explain, like, HCI to me then was a emergence of people, and I've written a little bit about this in terms of my view of how that emerged, kind of partly with some people on the technical side becoming curious why people weren't using the software, and also on the psychology side in terms of thinking of an applied psychology area of people using technology and thinking about this idea of the information processing model that we could ascribe kind of both computers and humans in the same way and describe them as processing information. And then after HCI, then you had CSCW, and that really,
which is computer-supported cooperative work, which is trying to bring attention to the social and collaborative aspects the social, of
to me, though, the common element was really about going back to even earlier, the human factors in computer systems, which is the original title of the HCI conference. And there was some work back in the 70s. In actual fact, there's an early Atwood and Ramsey back in 78, I think it was, had a bibliography of work in human factors and computer systems, which I got hold of. In 78, I spent a year, 78, 79, at Honeywell in Minnesota as a human factors intern. But I wrote to them. They were looking for more traditional performance human factors people. But I wrote and said, well, they should actually be interested in computing because more people were using computers and computer-based systems. And cognitive science was an emerging area. And so, tongue-in-cheek a little, I said they should hire somebody who had this mix of backgrounds in computing.
And lo and behold, I'm your man.
Yeah, and so they took a gamble. I was one of three people. The other two had more traditional human engineering programs. But actually, it turned out quite interesting that you're, in ways that I hadn't expected, part of that also because I had a link with the University of Minnesota, the Center for Research in Human Learning, Jim Jenkins Group, and there were some very interesting graduate students there who I found very interesting. There were also people at Honeywell, but what they discovered was in a way that the fact that I had some computing background as well and my interest in that area was actually quite suited to some of the projects they were doing. And it also opened my eyes a little bit to working in the military industrial complex, because a lot of the projects at Honeywell were on the defense system side, and that was something new to me given I'd come from Ireland and Canada, where it wasn't very big or non-existent. Not quite non-existent. There are a few defense projects in Canada, but not a lot of the communications and technology work in Canada wasn't military related. So what I'm saying is that, to my mind, the common element of all of this being going on to interaction design and participant design, the common element was really that I was interested in not just in the mechanisms in terms of the technology, but in terms of the fact that how it could supposedly support people. So my interest always had been in thinking of the technology as a medium through which allowed people to do things, either in terms of being a tool or in terms of being a medium through which they connect with others. My interest wasn't in trying to extract human expertise into the machine, but rather thinking of the machine as a tool or artifact. And that became more, it started out as a rather naive understanding, kind of in a sense just a concern about trying to support people, and also being concerned that I found a lot of people on the technology side just viewed people as stupid who had problems, you know, that they were stupid users. You know, they didn't understand. It's obvious, you know. It was, and I found this is really, like, at a certain moral level, I felt this was objectionable, thinking of most people in the world as being idiots. And also a bad design stance to be taking, because I think it's led to designing systems for idiots rather than trying to think about designing for competent human practitioners. And in that sense also, when I went to California as a postdoc to Don Norman's group, I spent also a lot of time interacting with a group there, Mike Cole and his group, the Laboratory for Comparative Human Cognition. And they were interested in cultural historical activity theory and Vygotskian traditions. And a major aspect of that was the idea of thinking of mediating artifacts, Vygotsky's notions of language as a mediator in terms of communication, and the idea that mind is not just something that is individual, that we move from the individual. The standard notion from the more traditional psychology was we had individual mind, then we might talk about the group or the social mind, the mass, or something larger. But it was very much, the first thing was the individual and the self, kind of an individual creation. Whereas in this other view, when you start reading Vygotsky, kind of Vygotsky, mind is social. And so the notion that we go from inter to intra rather than from intra to inter, I found fascinating. So there was a theoretical framework that I became interested in terms of looking at, in a sense, the ecosystem. It wasn't just the individual using the technology, which was very much the focus of a lot of HCI. But even from those early days, I had an interest in something larger than that individual human-computer dyad. And I think that's reflected, actually. I mean, in the work I did at San Diego, not that it was not very, it was very naive, it wasn't very well theoretically grounded, it wasn't experimentally well-founded, but in my own thinking, my time there, and to give credit to Don, although at times he was unsure where I was going and what I was doing, he actually gave me the space and and opening allowed me to actually explore. And that time in San Diego was very, very important in terms of my intellectual development, in terms of trying to kind of understand more and framing how to talk about these things. And even though the output from my time there is quite little. It can be seen in actually a tech report, parts of which appeared in three chapters in the user-centered system design book.
Yeah.
But if you read those
which
three chapters...
Which has been really pivotal.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I don't think so. But it influenced a few people. But what I don't think it comes across as strongly in the three pieces, because they're in separate parts of the book.
Right.
One was a little piece called Issues in Design, and that's talking a little bit about the ethics of design and about how we think about, you know, idiot-proof design and how we think about the people we're designing for. Mm. Just this very small note, a few pages. But the second piece was on the social, well, it ended up being called Helping Users Help Each Other.
Yeah.
But that piece was really talking about the social context of design, saying, you know, why are we spending all this effort on building help systems, computer automated help systems, and yet we do very few studies of how they're used.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, they're not used a lot. And partly the reason is because they're written from the perspective of the machine, and they describe all the features of the machine, but they're not written from a human practice perspective, as we would say today, in terms of an understanding of how do we what's useful here in the specific context of our work. And when we want to do something to make these systems usable in our daily context, we talk to our neighbor or somebody.
Yes.
And so why?
Yeah.
So in that, I try to raise this issue of how do we find out information? Rather than going to these help systems, we actually, very often we ask others, we ask people who have similar practices, and we learn from them. And then how come we never talk about that in HCI? How come we don't think, is there some way? And the next stage of that for me was, is there some way through the system we could have access to others in terms of online resources, not to a piece of dead text, but actually to live people. So in a sense, the third chapter is on computer-mediated communication, not in the classic sense of just how email comparing online and offline, but I put out a query on the early internet, which was an unused net, which was asking about collaboration tools using the technology as a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And the chapter is computers as communication devices. So saying not to look at the computer as a calculator or as a substitute human, but rather as a medium through which we can communicate. And it's kind of ironic in a sense, because the whole interest in social media, you could say, in exactly what Facebook does. It's, it's a medium.
Exactly.
And
so much of what we use technology
exactly.
for. So when you look back, because you have had many sort of shifts and moves and explorations throughout your career as these ideas, you know, evolve and new contexts are made and you go to new places. When you look back, what are the sorts of things where you think you have made a really strong contribution or the things that you're proudest of?
Well, I don't know. It's hard sometimes because in a sense I'm a bit of a sham in some sense, like in terms of a standard research profile, because I think the contribution I make is rather elusive one. It's kind of a allusive and elusive. Allusive in alluding to, relating. And I think the papers I write, most of them, they're not, well, I have a few pieces where there's empirical work, and that's also sometimes done with people in my group. But I think the contribution that I make is often trying to point to topics or issues and bringing in material that I think should be relevant. In some cases, I don't have a strong conceptual frame from first principles.
Yeah.
In some cases, I work with people because, of course, I have a specific view on certain things, but I also am influenced hugely by my collaborators, and I've had a huge number of collaborators. I really like working with people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the peoples in some of the pieces that are more well-known, of course, a lot of this strong kind of conceptual work is often done by my colleagues, I will say. But what I do is help shape it and frame it and relate it in a way. And I think, so I play this role that I think if we all did this, there'd be very little empirical research done of the proper kind, maybe. But I think there is a space for trying to move forward in terms of not always trying to be, quote, new, but it's trying to, in actual fact, part of what I think my contribution is in trying to say what's out there that we might learn from.
Yeah.
What other bodies of work may be relevant that we seem to be ignoring? And in a sense, although in some cases it might appear at first that, I'm all over the place. Actually, I think there is a core, and the core is basically, in a sense, human-centered design, or a focus on people. And it so happens, because I did computing, I'm surrounded by people working with technology and artifacts and systems that supposedly support people, but yet they don't. So I was very happy with CSCW, Computer Support for Collaborative Work, and as Kel and I, Kel Smith, one of my major collaborators for many years, like what we were interested in was that idea of support for people and people's practices, and not starting out with just groupware or technology, but to understand how people do things and then how we can maybe design better technology that fits into those practices. Yeah. And in that sense, like, it also led me into an interest in, with the sociology and anthropology people, like Lucy Suchman's work originally, and in showing again how, you know, understanding the context of work, the local organization of work, and then the ethnomethodology people and the sociologists with their concern about members' practices and the way in which work is something that is achieved, not a given. And so it gave a lens, a very detailed account of how work gets done, which I thought was extremely helpful for people in design to think about and to realize, not to talk about abstractions.
To talk about the stupid user.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're a really good example of taking advantage of having eclectic interests and being broad intellectually. There's some ways in which now many of our measures almost sort of presume or require us to be deep and to be known for one thing, but you've crafted a career, probably not intentionally, I'm assuming, in being able to exploit the synergies at these intersections and with very diverse collaborators because you have these broad interests.
Yeah, although the way you phrased the question, maybe I think it might bothers me. People are always saying I'm concerned about things. I'm always having concerns. It concerns me a little because it makes it sound a bit as if eclectic. So you do lots of different things and then maybe you can bring them in. I think there's a sense in which, as I said, my interest is in people, in not just moving out from psychology. It's not just the individual mind, because actually I don't believe there is so much in the individual mind. And also, ironically, although I was trained in cognitive psychology and information processing psychology, I've actually, you know, I became disillusioned with that quite early on, in the mid, late 70s, even when I was doing my thesis. And I kind of became very antithetical to the AI movement and became very critical of it because it seemed to all the time posit as if, though, you know, that sort of the mind, the computer was a good mechanism for our, a model of what it is to be human and of the mind. And I don't think it is. It might have, it's a model, but it leaves out a whole lot of things. Like in that early days of psychology, we didn't talk about emotions. Emotions were some epiphenomenon, or we ignored it. And yet emotions are so fundamental to what it is to be human. Yet for many years it was ignored. So, I mean, my interest has moved more in terms of understanding humans, humankind, in a sense, more sociological, anthropological perspectives on understanding society, the nature of human society, and the evolution of, in that sense, my interest in artifacts. It's not just about, you know, industrial design, but or buildings or whatever, which I'm also interested in, people living in spaces, because my interest is in human activity, and human activity is also
encompasses all of these,
but it encompasses artifacts. We make from the earliest tool, man as a tool user. Like we live in houses, we have habitation, we domesticate animals, we live with others.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, that interest in people is fundamental. And because I did computing, the interest then becomes the artifacts that we create, and these new kinds of artifacts since the dawn of computing, which don't, in many cases, disrupt our lives, and can we do it better?
Yeah.
You know? But the problem is always that too much we focus on the artifact. Yeah. How can this app help us in our lives?
Yeah.
And what I've been trying to do, because from a work point of view, I've normally ended up in computing departments because that's where there are jobs.
Yeah.
But I've always, in a sense, believe that informatics should also encompass the social. Actually, social informatics, I mean, Rob Kling and others use that term, but I don't even like the term because to me, informatics
is social.
Is inherently, foundationally social because it's about people and artifacts. And if you're going to design artifacts, people are going to work with them, and therefore you should know something about people. It doesn't mean you train them as psychologists or anthropologists or ethnographers, but anybody studying computing, it should also encompass like the context in which computing developed back to the days of, even you go back to Babbage and calculating machines. I mean, he also needed locksmiths and designers and blacksmiths to build those tools. Yeah. And we very often ignore the skill sets of these people in creating the things and in using, in fashioning a product. So human computer, I don't like the term human computer interaction, by the way, but that's another story. I don't like the term user.
But that reflects your focus on the human, the person, like very much that.
Yeah, the human society, really. Yeah. And that is the common thread. So for me, the interest in CSCW, the interest in designing interactive systems is more the interest in the design process, on how we open up design, on how we try to democratize design. My interest in participative design, when I first encountered it in the early 80s, was through some of the work in Scandinavia. And again, I've been very influenced by many people there, and my link with Aarhus, with Susanna Butler, and others have been very influential for me. But my interest was, I felt at the time in San Diego, we were doing user-centered design, focusing on the user in the sense of psychologists understanding the user. But we weren't really still at the point of involvement in design.
Yeah.
And that idea of actually reading about people really involving, working with people in trade unions and the workers kind of, and understanding their expertise. Mm. So I loved this idea, and one of the papers somebody wrote about, you know, not expert systems, but system for experts.
Yeah,
you know?
Nice. Yep.
The idea of, and another early influence of mine that many people may not have heard of, that I've been influenced by, is an Irish engineer who worked at Lucas and Lucas Aerospace, Mike Cooley. And I heard Mike Cooley talk in the early 70s and was very influenced by that. And he had an interest in the work of Marx and manual labor and tools and the notion of skill and tool sets and technology, building on that. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make an antithesis, but I'm trying to rethink the relationship between people, tools, computers in ways that are very different to the thinking that I found in a lot of computer science and AI, which was very much kind of, you know, the human as a meat machine, kind of, and like that as a machine, basically. The other influence, I guess, back in the late 70s, early 80s, was Terry Winograd and his work with floors and that, and the emerging drafts of that book I was privy to. And that helped me in the idea of moving from, you know, to realize that we needed something other than the information processing model. I talk about a bit with that in the late 80s, with paper with Susanna, Beyond the Interface, Encountering Artifacts and News, which appeared in Jack Carroll's book. But that talks a bit about that history. But to me, it's, so just to go back, when you kind of prompted about eclecticism, I just wanted to, I do have wide interest in history and literature.
I guess I don't mean eclecticism in a derogatory way, but there's value in having the interest, the skills, the intellectual capacity to make these links and draw these connections. There's a particular role that, move intellectually as a community that we get from those sorts of discussions that we don't get just from those of us who might stay within a little bubble or a silo, a very narrow area.
Well, I think there's space, and maybe what I would say, because I sometimes feel like Forrest Gump, because I feel like I appeared in places. I happen to be very fortunate
appeared
by chance in a way. A lot of interesting points of inflection in
which this article sort of draws out really nicely.
Yeah, because I got, for instance, being with Don Norman's and Steve Draper, the user-centered to the human-computer interaction project, human-machine interaction project at UC San Diego, in the early 80s. That was one of the early, very early HCI projects.
Mm. And yeah.
Because I, again, they found me interesting because I'd done this psychology and computing, human factors. I'd been at Honeywell. I had this human factors and computer systems sort of link. And so there weren't many people with, there weren't undergraduate programs and this stuff. So that was interesting. I mean, I met a lot of interesting people there. And as I said, I also had links to other people at San Diego outside of the cognitive science group who also were influential to me. People in sociology. I took a course in ethnomethodology from Bud Meehan at that time. And then by chance, I met Lucy Suchman at that time. I had connections with people at Xerox PARC and was influenced by some people there, and that got me thinking about things. And then I was back in Dublin working on a conference where I had an influence of a sociologist friend of mine. And she was much interested in the larger, kind of more socialist understanding of science and technology. And it opened my mind. It moved me out of this narrower frame that I had been having. But it opened me out to a larger literature on the sociology of science and on kind of theories of human labor and practice. And then I had the PD, Participative Design Influence. I met some people, Morten Kung and Pellean and Susanna Butker, and they kindly invited me to come with them because they were interested in making a link with the San Diego HCI, this emerging HCI community. So I went there, and then while they were there, they had this link with the new Rank Xerox Europark group that was set up in Cambridge in England. And so I went there, and then I made contact with some of the sociologists there, Christian Heath and David Randall and Richard Harper and other people who were connected.
So all of this, you've just talked about lots of travel and living in lots of different places. What's been, can you reflect on that just as a, I don't know, from a lived experience perspective in terms of putting down roots or not, or, you know, what was the costs of needing or doing all those moves or the advantages of doing all those moves?
Okay, well, a couple of big ones. Let's see, the first move outside of Ireland. I mean, Ireland in the late 60s, early 70s was still very closed in certain ways, and I just felt it still very, in certain ways, I felt limiting and limited, and I wanted to explore elsewhere. It's not, you know, I had this idea of if I stayed in Ireland, and so at that time a lot of people did. They did their training in the one country and got
a lot of
positions.
People do. Yeah.
But I was curious. I wanted to learn. I wanted to visit other countries. Mm. I hadn't visited Ireland. Wasn't in the EU at this stage, you know. It was, so we were traveling to the continent was a big thing. I didn't have much travel at all. So I wanted to go to an English-speaking country, well, because I didn't think it'd be easy to, it wasn't easy to go to Europe at that time or work in France or Italy without the language. So I had the, definitely felt, okay, I'll go away for the, and then when I got there, there were two types of people I met who left from Ireland. One group of people who hated Ireland, like they'd gotten fed up and really said, I'm never going back, I want to go wherever, US, Australia, wherever, away. And there were other people who were very definitely going away for some training, but they definitely were coming back, you know. I didn't fit in either category. I was just, wasn't sure, I didn't have a fixed view. So I went, and then I got the option to go to the States for a year. I did that in Minnesota. Then I came back and did a little bit of consulting in Ireland, just briefly, in between things. Then I got the chance for the postdoc in California, so I moved there.
So you never had this career plan from the sounds of it. It's been really in the moment and responding to opportunities or taking advantage of opportunities as they rose.
Yeah, that's, I didn't actually, you know, at the end of my PhD, it ended up, the thesis was still connected with this earlier sort of issue around representations and cognitivist models and that. And I didn't feel happy continuing with that sort of stuff. So I, in a sense, had a bit of a dilemma about what to do next. So I was, in a sense, fortunate because of this HCI interest that, and the connections that my supervisor still had. So I had sort of entry points into some good places. And then I got taken up I had the option actually of going to work in an office automation consulting firm in Toronto or move to San Diego.
And somehow I can't see you in an office automation.
An interesting group. Yeah. It was the former Bell Northern lab that Don Tapscott set up. But anyway, so I moved to California, and then I did something else. I actually stopped and went traveling in Asia.
Yeah.
So one of the funny little anecdotes is if you look at the user-centered, the sense system design book, and you look at the front at the list of contributors, you have all these people, you know, MIT Media Lab, Xerox PARC, University of California, San Diego, and then there's one address that's not a university address, and it's 16 Fortfield Avenue, Turner, Dublin 6, Ireland. That's my parents' address, it's my home, because at that stage when the book came out in 86, I was traveling in Asia.
You're a peripatetic academic.
Where I intended spending a couple of months, I thought, but I ended up spending almost 2 years on the road outside of academia.
Yeah.
So my CV has this one line which says on leave.
So did that impact, well, it doesn't sound like it impacted, you know.
It was difficult. I mean, actually, a lot of my friends said, you can't leave if you stop.
I know, there's that sense that you can't stop.
It was difficult, to be honest. I arrived back in, I moved to Aarhus in January in 1988. And I've been basically on the road from July of 85.
Wow.
So, and I came back into a research group, into living in a small apartment and into another country where, yes, my work colleagues, we spoke English, but it was another country. They actually speak Danish now, I guess. It took a while, yeah. It was a bit, at a personal level, it was, I ended up having, you know, some interesting, good times, you know, but it was, it was not easy. But I've always been a bit of a loner, I guess, so I'm never really certain about, as other people who know me, is I'm not so good at making decisions. At the same time, I actually made some of these rather big decisions, I fell into them.
And, I mean, one of them, you stopped working formally, would you say retired a few years ago? And you've also had an interesting last couple of years since then as well.
Yeah, well, I skip over after, or quickly, kind of, I was a couple of years in Aarhus, but I wasn't sure. That was a computer science department. And again, I still had this feeling that I wasn't quite sure if that was the home I should have, because I felt in terms of the profile of what people should be, even though there was space there for the systems development group, it still was a bit of an issue for me.
So what people should be in terms of what a good academic, a CV looks like, is that what you mean?
No, in the context of computer science, being a member, being a senior faculty member in computer science, and what kinds of courses you should be teaching. Yeah. And my interest over the years has even moved further away from, in a sense, the details of the technology per se, and more into kind of understanding the practices and the, so I guess, and the sociological kind of interests. So it just felt, in a sense, as I said, I felt at one stage I would like to try to create a new sort of discipline, that some sort of media and informatics or social informatics, although the way in which some of that media work has gone, I would question a little bit. I think it's become, or some of it I don't find so, it's become too tech-based, too removed from actual practice. So it was really, where was your home, one's intellectual home? Because it's interesting, like if I look at certain committees now, and there's an arts and humanities group, there's a social science group, there's a engineering
and you can relate
group,
to all of them.
And I can relate to all of them. And in actual fact, some of the things I do and some of the people I know or even have worked with would be in each of those categories.
Indeed.
But if I go up for review by any one of those, they look at me and say, you're not a psychologist, you're not publishing in psychology, you're not a sociologist, you're not a computer scientist, you're not a media theorist. And so in that sense, there's a potential price in that. And I think it happens with new interdisciplinary fields. So we've had that discussion a bit more recently about CSCW, that certain faculty people feel that it's in their younger people that it's a problem because of, like, in terms of if they say they do CSCW, it doesn't necessarily help in their promotions committee or whatever.
Yeah.
And I understand that problem, that on the one hand, some of these areas are where interesting things are happening, but it really is maybe a bleeding edge, that it's leading edge in the sense of it's bringing together new areas, and there is sometimes a real buzz and some real energy in the confluence of these different areas.
Yeah.
But there also is a price to pay in that it can be difficult to get acceptance, or there may be new journals appearing which you can get into, but then those don't get ranked highly, and so your publication channels are reduced. And so, yeah, it's...
So what would you say to a younger academic now who's dealing with some of those questions?
Well, at the end of the road, like, you know, if you look back on your life, I think it's maybe hard to consider this when you're in your late 20s or early 30s and doing your postdoc or trying to get your first position and get tenure.
Yeah.
And I mean, the pressures are, I do believe that the pressures on young academics are ferocious these days, much worse than it used to be. And there used to be more space for people to do their own thing. There were, in different countries, people had different, well, it used to be in some of the Northern European countries, there was more scope for people to carve their own path.
Mm.
But I mean, there's this relentless pressure worldwide, also in terms of a homogenization of programs, a reduction in what counts as good science, good work. And I think this is really flawed and problematic, and that it tends to end up coming to a least common denominator. Of course, there was some shoddy work done at the edges.
Yeah.
I'm not denying that. But the point is that there's also new ideas and kind of ways of thinking about problems that really, if we don't allow that, if we don't give people some space to think outside the box, like, we're going to be stuck in the box.
Yes.
And
yeah.
it's a very small, I believe it's a very small box.
Yeah.
So I, in terms of advice to young people, I think it's very difficult, and I don't want to belittle the problem that's there. And I haven't really, to be honest, I haven't given enough thought to this. I mean, what I've tried to do when I had some control or influence myself and I had some support or resources was to create a space. And I used to say, this is probably a rather weak line, but I wanted to try and create a space where we could have interesting people and give them some freedom to do things. Now, some of that turned out not to be very good. Some of it turned out not to work. Some of it turned out to be really interesting. Mm. And I think, I hope that some of the people who, when I did have the lab in Limerick, the Interaction Design Centre, and with some of my colleagues there, we did create a space where I think we had fun. We, not just that, it wasn't a sense of being selfish, just having fun ourselves, but we tried to make a difference. We tried to do something. We tried to create linkages. We brought in people. I had people coming from communication and media studies. I had one of my former people, like now, who here were speaking at the UCSCW conference, who's now Professor Luigina Cialfi. She came in from communication and media studies from Siena. I mean, we had people from different countries.
Yeah.
We had an architect, Parag, who came from India, somebody who is a qualified architect. We had people from software engineering. We had people from art and design school. We started a new master's in interactive media, and many of the students came in from the School of Art and Design. And that was really influential and interesting to have those people in our group. So we created an interesting space.
Nice, yeah.
But in a sense, because I wasn't, and this is, I guess, my fault as the leader, I wasn't focused enough or determined enough. It was, we probably didn't, within the organization, we didn't push enough on the policy or politics front.
Yeah.
We created a space, and as long as I brought in money, we could keep that space because we were basically self-sufficient. Most of the people in the group were, we were paying on grants.
Yeah.
It was soft money.
Yeah.
We didn't have many faculty positions. And once that tied up near the end, when I started having some health issues and I became on that. I was the only senior faculty member. We'd wanted to do other junior faculty, but it was difficult. It wasn't seen as strategic within the structure, so it just shrank.
So the politics is important, but it would be exhausting as well. And it's always decisions and trade-offs, isn't it, where you devote your energy?
It is, yeah. And I think one of the things is that you've got to, it's really important to try and have collaborators, whether they're in the same faculty or not, or although it can be difficult within the university system, you may have good collaborators in different faculties, but the problem is they are ultimately subservient to their head of department or their faculty, and it can be problematic. So although there's a lot of lip talk about interdisciplinarity and creating new interdisciplinary research institutes, you really need to have a core group. And the problem is that we never got critical mass in terms of, regular faculty in that group to make it sustainable. Mm. So there are real issues, but when you're struggling to actually just do something year on year, it's also difficult to have that longer term plan or to spend the time in the politics side of it to try to work out. But
you're making me think that in an ideal world, so like what I like that you did was just recognizing that you didn't fit any neat silos, but created your own and brought people together and built something. Hmm. But it's also recognizing the mix of skills you need to do that sustainable long-term perspective of it. And like I know I'm not very good at politics, so if I want to do something like that, I would need to think about bringing someone in who was going to be good at that politics and external facing things and
Exactly. I mean, I was just talking to another senior person about this recently, just at this conference, and I actually was saying to this person that maybe they should think about hiring somebody on the PR communications or this side of it, or to have a chief operating officer or somebody to. The problem, of course, is how you justify that on soft money in your own project. It can be difficult to actually get full salary for somebody.
But recognizing that we now, to operate in these sorts of environments and to do the interesting research at these cross-disciplinary edges, we need more than just good academic research skills.
Sure. I think to be honest, I never really felt I wanted to be a director, manager sort of person. And near the end, like with several projects, and I couldn't myself be involved in all the projects, and it became like you felt a loss of, and that's actually what's made me feel it's time to, I need to step out of this, because we were still doing things and we had projects, but I was becoming more and more removed. And some of the personal interests I had were not the things that were being funded.
Yeah.
So we had to go after funding to support the people, but they were in some cases a bit more removed from what I found really interesting. Yeah. And so it started a realization that here I was working on a couple of things which I was doing on my own, in my own time, that I found motivating. Mm. One of those was about forgetting and remembering and forgetting. And it was a topic that I was quite fascinated by, but I didn't have the time or the space to actually package it as a research proposal.
And yes, that was the thing that was really exciting.
And at the same time, there were these other projects which I needed to be more hands-on working with, and I wasn't. I was kind of missing from my group during that, and I realized, no, this is not.
Yeah, it's not where your energy was.
Yeah, and also I had at that time I had some health issues which were just taking my energy away. Because I lived a lot of my life, I've been, relationships, and I actually probably sacrificed too much. I kind of got wrapped up in this academic world. And while there were, of course, I met a lot of really good people, and there were people who were not just my academic colleagues, but also were social friends and collaborators over several years around Europe that I still value highly. But it's not, they're not actually there necessarily when you go back to where is home, and suddenly what is home? And that became a question. There's a dilemma sometimes, you move so often. I talk about that sometimes with people who've moved. So I went back to Ireland, yes, but I never in some ways a part of me has never really fully settled back there.
Mm.
And also I'm not really part of the establishment there.
In the academic sense, yeah, or in the local community sense?
No, in the academic sense, yeah, or in the, yeah, local community, because I don't, while I have had partnerships, I haven't really settled, and I don't have children, I don't have, in terms of embedding yourself in the local environment, so I've been away a lot, so I think as time goes on, you suddenly realize that we are still, although we talk about nomadic life, I mean, there's an element also in which we still need place, we need groundedness,
and
it can be difficult. It can be difficult, and balancing these things as you go through your career can be quite difficult.
I'm sort of connecting that to what your theme of your own research is, which is about being human, you know, at the core.
People. Part of it for me, in terms of moving places, was to learn.
Mm.
You know, like as I said, it's not that I have this theory and I'm trying to beat everybody over the head with it, but what I do have is a stance, a perspective.
Mm.
We can use the term human-centered design, although I don't like some of the other labels, I don't particularly like that label for reasons I might go into another time. But it was an attempt to at least say, my interest is around people and the world in which they live, and the ecosystem in which they are in, which includes other people, artifacts, the workplace, their physical neighborhoods, you know, the environment. Mm. So in that sense, I'm interested in that whole ecosystem and systems thinking. I mean, that's why I'm interested in going back and trying to bring in some aspects from even earlier literature. What are there still things of relevance in the socio-technical literature, even in some of the cybernetics literature, second order cybernetics especially, which included the observer in the process, not just about the technical system. Yeah, so it's, as I said, I think my role is, as I said, not as some visionary, I don't think, or somebody who is a theorist actually, but somebody maybe who, in a sense, was trying to ask questions and trying to raise questions, which at the time, maybe within the field, certainly within the computing field, were not being asked very much. And so they were at least trying to open the door. Maybe that's a way to put it as a metaphor. Opening a door, letting a chink of light in to other work. And
doors are connections.
Making connections. Yeah. So, like, if people are curious, the last, that little forgetting paper, which I actually quite like because it's appeared in Co-Design, the journal, in 2006, I'm not sure, but it's called Forgetting is a Feature, Not a Bug. The main message was really just saying that this fascination about the capture of things, video recording, SenseCam, Microsoft SenseCam, this idea of, you know, suddenly we're going to record thousands of images and we're going to record every phone call and every community. Somehow that this was going to increase our awareness of the world and our kind of our memory of ourselves and whatever. There seemed to me a fundamental lack of understanding in these visions, these bizarre visions, techno visions, of what it was to be human, what it was to be a person in the world, how remembering is an active process. It's not a computer recording of something. How forgetting is an integral part of our human activity. How social forgetting is also an important part. Mm. And of course, it's important we don't forget certain things. I mean, or we repeat mistakes of the past. But there's a sense in which forgetting, to a point, as a thinking about it as a design issue, that there are times when we don't want to be recorded. And to think about that as a design space, so it's not for or against a particular capture model, it's to try and create scenarios that are believable in the sense of what it means to be human. And when I read in the early days, say, of ambient intelligence, which is, I think of as the second or third coming of AI, there's this notion of us being surrounded by these intelligent artifacts that would do things for us, that would be agents for us and human-like, that we would discuss. It seemed to me that it was like a very strange, perfect world that didn't make any sense. And it was really in the context of that that I started developing this issue around forgetting. Mm. But the other thing I wanted to say about that article is, again, it's not a standard scientific article, but it's a walk through a space. And in that walk, I kind of try to link to history, to philosophy, to psychology, to sociology, to law. I mean, because people have talked about issues around forgetting and memory and history in all these areas. And I believe that making us aware of some of these nuances might make us come up with more believable scenarios. And another area that I would mention just briefly would be in the health area, where again, or the intelligent home assisted living and some of these areas, where again, I think we too often start with a piece of technology. And thankfully now in the last few years, I think we're starting to get the message across. I talk about that in the little 2012 paper on in the interactions.
I'll put a link to all of these on the webpage. So Liam, any comments in closing?
In a way, when I look back at some of the things I've done, I think I've been very fortunate just to happen to be kind of in spaces and places where things were changing, and I happen to be interested in those ages, and I've had some bleeding at those ages, but actually most of the time I've actually been able to have a good view and to actually walk with people, really interesting people. I've learned
really
so much.
Really interesting people.
Yeah, I've learned so much. I feel so fortunate in the colleagues I've had and in the journey I've had with people, kind of, and I've learned so much over these years. But at the same time, I think there's a core there, which is always that I started out with this interest and concern with people and their world, and that's still there. It's just such a richer framework and understanding I have of that now than when I started.
Yeah.
And maybe some of it, in terms of any message to anybody or what they might find of interest, is that in some of the bits and pieces I've written, actually a lot of them are kind of essays, really. They're kind of perspectives or positionings. One of my favorite words is, two of my favorite words are framing and perspectives. And in that sense, some of the work in design around what is a problem, problem formulation, is very important to me, because I think very often we start to solve a problem without knowing what the problem is. It's the wrong problem. And so I think a lot of the time, having a look at how you understand what it is you're doing, what is the frame you're in, are you comfortable with it, does it seem that it's actually suitable for what you're doing? So I think some people find that at times refreshing, that they've maybe some of the things open a little vista, or open that little door into a space maybe they hadn't thought about. And I'm happy to hear if it encourages people not to follow me in a particular path, but rather to actually follow their own path, in the sense of actually exploring something that maybe is not necessarily approved by your immediate superior or whatever, but that is what the road you feel you want to travel.
Yeah, yeah.
So go do it.
Go do it, yes. Yeah. Yep. And so thank you. And just in terms of influence, I was reminded then that there was a book some years ago where we were asked to contribute a chapter that reflected what was really influential in our work. And the paper that I wrote about was the paper that you and Kelt wrote in the early days of CSEW, and how that's been really influential in setting my own career trajectory off. So I personally have a lot to thank you for. And just thank you for your time now.
And it's interesting to try to articulate a vision, because at that time we had seen some work in CSEW which seemed to, rather than opening out the space, the possibilities of the technology, was starting to embed within the technology protocols for in a sense embedding social protocols in the technology now at the group level. And so to me this was completely anathema to the idea of what CSCW should be. Mm. And then the interest in trying to say we're not starting with the technology, so we parse CSCW from right to left, not left to right. We try to understand work, cooperative work, supporting it, and then we talk about the role of technology.
Yeah. So this is a perfect example of your framing and perspective.
Hmm. Yeah, thank you. I think we're both Cal and I are very happy to see that the paper, although it was published initially in this obscure, brand new journal on CSCW, the journal which we actually started along with some others. But it's really nice to see that people still find that it gives a position and it articulates a position on a set of issues which people still find
relevant. Which is also a good story about starting the new journal, new conference, a new interdisciplinary research area that was new then and still exists and is more mainstream, and that papers can still get cited from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Liam, thank you, and wishing you all the very best.
You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. And you can follow Change Acad Life on Twitter. And I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.